This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The composer Marvin Hamlisch died this week. He was 68. For almost half a century, Hamlisch made his way into our heads with ballad after show-stopping ballad. What I Did for Love from A Chorus Line, The Way We Were, and one of the best James Bond songs ever.
Nobody does it better. Makes me feel sad for the rest. Nobody does it half as good as you.
I talked with Marvin Hamlisch in 2009. He'd just written the terrific soundtrack for the Steven Soderbergh movie The Informant, about a corporate whistleblower played by Matt Damon. Hamlisch hadn't scored a film for a dozen years before that, and I asked what drew him back.
One of the chief things that did it was I get a phone call directly from Steven Soderbergh. I was an absolute, you know, like, wow. And he took me to lunch and explained to me that he had this film and that he used as the temporary track for the film music from Bananas, which was my third film that I did.
The Woody Allen movie.
The Woody Allen movie. And he said what he loved about it was he loved the energy of it, and he wanted to basically had me do the music for this film, this Matt Damon film. So I went to see it, which I loved. It's a very interesting film because the protagonist is a bipolar person. Okay, now
among other problems.
Amongst other problems, but that's the key problem. And the thing was that for 2 weeks, I am not kidding you when I tell you, you know, when you're working on a score for a film, you try to figure out first how you get in, the key to the door of getting into the film. Once you're in, it's actually much easier than you think it is to score. All of a sudden, I'm walking in the streets of New York, and it dawns on me that I'm thinking of this all wrong. I've got to start thinking of it the way the main character would be thinking. And the way, if you take it from his point of view, it turns out that he is just having the best time of his life, and the FBI are nuts.
Well, let's play a clip that illustrates, right, I think, exactly what you're talking, right, about. This is the Matt Damon character, Mark Whitaker, who is meeting with his FBI,
right,
agent handler for the first time, and we hear then one of his inner monologues.
He seems like a real good guy. I hope he doesn't mind me calling him Brian instead of Agent Shepard. I might even try Bri out. This must be very different for him, talking to a guy like me instead of a bank robber or a drug dealer. I could see us fishing or whatever. What a good listener. You don't meet one of those every day.
And now, and there's your happy theme.
Well, exactly, and right, and it so works. And I've never been as conscious of music actually making comedy work as well as it does in this film.
Well, I thank you. The truth was, once I started and got the idea of I'm going with happy-go-lucky guy and everybody else is nuts, this just comes to you. Now, this is not what you call music that's going to be hidden somewhere. You know, this is not this kind of music.
No, it's very foreground.
It's very foreground. I'll tell you a very sweet story about foreground. This has never happened in my life, okay? We went to see the premiere in New York City. At the party, I saw Steven, and I embraced him and said, thank you for this opportunity. And his wife told me that after the first 5 minutes of the film, he went upstairs to the projectionist and said, give me more music. You know, I want it louder. Nobody does that. You know?
Was it interesting for you, a guy who, because you started literally when you were a child, no,
right,
joke, at writing music for movies, you were working in the early 60s.
Right, oh yeah.
Then to do this sort of ironic pastiche of,
right, yeah,
60s for,
yeah,
this film?
Easy for me. Very, yeah, easy. I was there. I was there. So yes, it was a simple thing to do.
You have written plenty of jaunty songs,
yes,
and scores. You also, in film, did the scores for serious movies like Ordinary,
yes,
People and Sophie's,
oh, yeah,
Choice.
Oh, yeah.
Is that an entirely different Marvin Hamlisch head that does,
right,
those kinds of films?
In fact, the way I try to explain it to people is, think of my brain, the music part of my brain, as a cassette machine. And all you keep doing is, depending on what the movie is, you change the rules of the cassette. So you change the cassette. You say, no, we're going to do a beautiful theme with sadness. There it is. You know, we're going to do a theme about, you know, and you just, you literally have to take in, look, it's the same
I want you all here all the time just playing behind the show.
If you've ever been at the United Nations, you know how that moment comes, it's so great, where someone's speaking in, I don't know, Hungarian, speaking in Hungarian, and you hear the person say, and now, with a simultaneous interpretation, right? A translation, they say. Simultaneous translation, and you put on the headset. Well, if you think of music as a language, all I'm doing is taking my thoughts in English. Well, this should be funny. This should be this. This should really get you. This should really hurt. This should, you know, and translating what I'm feeling about a scene into music.
And I guess you're so fluent at that. I mean, it's almost what psychologists call synesthesia, right? Where words go directly into music.
Exactly. Right. Definitely.
You've been doing this
forever.
Film scoring for 40 years.
Yep.
Is the process any different now than it was in 1967?
I used to work at home on a moviola. Now, a moviola makes an incredible amount of noise.
Those are those old-fashioned editing tables.
Tables. So. And you hear, I mean, you're trying to write a music, and you're hearing, like that. Well, not only are you hearing it, but your neighbor's hearing it, you know? And it's a huge machine, and people would go crazy. And, you know, it was horrible. I remember all these films that I used to work on. We worked on the print that was in black and white. I mean, the way we were, writing a beautiful number for the way we were in black and white is not the easiest thing in the world. So in those respects, it's wonderful. I have to tell you, I'm still of the old school. I still write with a pen or a pencil. I don't use synthesizers that much. I use them, but I don't use them that much. Like I always say, I'm not here to paint white on a white wall. I'm here to put salt and pepper on something. You know what I mean? Some directors, I have to say, like a Steven Soderbergh, wants to put that music out there. He liked it. A George Roy Hill, you know, who did The Sting, he liked it, you know? Other directors want you to basically be a carpet, meaning we don't really know it's a carpet. We don't even look at the carpet.
But it has to be there.
But it feels good.
The Sting, George Roy Hill... from 1973. Now, people would not know Scott Joplin or ragtime probably generally were it not for you reaching into the vaults.
But actually, before I reached into the vault, the person who's really responsible is the son of George Roy Hill, because it's the son of George Roy Hill who kept playing ragtime at home. And George Roy Hill said, "What is that?" And what George Roy Hill loved about this music is the same exact thing that Soderbergh loved about Bananas. He said, "I love the energy of this music, and I love that it has a twinkle in its eye." So here's the deal. Sometimes this happens in life. Ready? It's 5 o'clock at night. It's raining in New York City. You know you're never going to get a cab, right? You know it. It's raining in New York, 5 o'clock, you might as well forget it. I always used to say, if you're going from the east side to the west side, you better be born there because you're not going to get a cab. You walk outside, and all of a sudden, a woman steps out of a cab, and you get the cab, right? I mean, it's like, how did that happen, right? It happens. In the same way, let me tell you what happened. So I go to the library in L.A., the music library, and I pick out everything of Scott Joplin. I'm talking about every piece of music that Scott Joplin ever wrote. I put them all in front of me, and I go in and I actually pick my favorite moments. I go, I like this, I don't like this, I like this, I don't like this, right?
From records or from actual sheet music?
No, sheet music. And I'm not kidding you when I tell you that the actual doing this film maybe took me 6 days because, like the woman who steps up, everything fit. It was like, you know, it was like perfect. It was like as if they had made the movie after they heard the music, you know? So now you can't call up a studio and say, I've just done...
You got to wait a few weeks to make it look hard.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So 3 weeks later, they say, how's it going? I said, well, you know, this baby is really tough. But I'm muddling through, you know, as I'm sitting out there going, another, daiquiri, please. But what happened was, it was an amazing thing. The things that I did in the film that I'm proud of, that I'm really proud of, but people don't know. But, you know, this theme...
Which is Scott, the famous theme, yeah.
That's Scott Joplin. But what I put on next to it was mine, which went... Ba-da-da.
Oh, so you actually improved it.
Yeah, I don't know about improved it. I just added that because I wanted that melancholy solo violin. And there was a couple of things I wrote for the film, but... It was amazing. I mean, every time I would say to myself, all right, I'm going to give 2 hours to this scene. I'm going to work on it. 20 minutes later, I go, I can't believe it. It's done. And I would look at it and say, is this possible? But, you know, when something is bound to work, it just works.
Back before you did any of this, you were studying music at the age of 5 and became the youngest person ever admitted to Juilliard at
right.
7 or something. Your first hit, you weren't much older.
No.
You were 21. It was Leslie Gore saying, "Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows."
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny. When you're near, the rain goes, disappears, dear, and I feel so fine. Just to know that you are mine. That's enough, right?
And 44 years later,
yeah.
As it happens, that song, of course, is in this week's huge box office smash.
Which is it?
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
That song's in there?
You didn't know that?
I had no idea.
So you're competing with yourself.
Oh, my God.
And you didn't even know it. In fact, you beat yourself.
Oh, my God.
That was the number one movie, and The Informant was the number two movie.
Well, at least it's there. That's what counts.
But here you are. You're a successful musician. You've been to Juilliard. You're 19 years old when the Beatles come.
Right.
You're in your 20s as the 60s are happening. Did you feel out of sync with your generation?
Always. I've always felt out of sync. In fact, I still feel out of sync, and I'll tell you why. I grew up with parents who were from Vienna. My father was Viennese, schooled in Vienna. The fact that we don't even have an arts minister drove him crazy about America. He couldn't believe it. He just couldn't believe he was in the country without an arts minister. You can tell in the fourth grade that I'm out of it, because in the fourth grade I still have my picture of the fourth grade picture, you know, with the class. I'm the only one wearing a tie. Now, why is that? I never did the bar scene. I never did the pills and the liquor. It wasn't my thing.
But you didn't like, you know, just rock and roll either.
Well, I liked rock and roll. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved good night, sweet. I loved that. I loved dum, 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 dum. I mean, I love the songs. The 60s, the Beatles were to die. But it was hard for me. You know, when you sit down at the piano and you try to write what we call like music. Okay, what do you want to do? I want you to write a song like Henry Mancini.
Well, waiter,
yeah,
martini.
Right. You can do it, but you are not really writing what you would normally write. You're trying to sound like somebody. And I always felt I was out of it because my father particularly always used to talk about, you got to write a good melody.
It's as though you came of it. You were this prodigy. You
right.
came of age at this moment. And that's yeah. the musical DNA that stuck, right?
You're right, exactly. My goal in life was to write a Broadway show before I was 30 years old. And I started taking jobs as a rehearsal pianist and things. You know, that's how I met Barbra Streisand on Funny Girl and other shows. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, because I did well in Hollywood, I get my phone call. The phone call I've been waiting for. Now, look, when you're 29 years old, you think you've been waiting 140 years. You know what I mean? I know it sounds ridiculous, but if you've been waiting for a phone call since you're about 11 years old, it's a long time. And it was Michael Bennett, who I certainly knew. And he said, come to New York. I have an idea for a show. And that turned out to be Chorus Line.
Chorus Line, the thing you're proudest of?
Yes, it is, definitely. I mean, because remember, when you're starting a show, you're one of the creators. You're not the person brought in after everybody else has done it and you go, now give me some music. You're from the very beginning. It was a great, first of all, it was great because all the people who worked on it, except for Michael, we were all novices. We were all just dying to do something great. And Broadway, for me, was the place where the serious composer who didn't want to write... who wanted to write a tune, you know? That was the place where you're going to do that. That's why Stephen Sondheim is a Broadway writer. Well, if you go to Broadway now these days, what you're hearing is more... you're hearing more of that stuff, and it's become a world of revivals, a world of shows that all come from England, a world of...
Disney animated soundtracks
Disney stuff,
on, yeah.
And a world of movies that now are shows. And... That depresses me.
There's less ambition, you're saying.
Oh, totally less. I mean, now, as I say, it's not show business anymore. It's the business of show. I mean, it's and I have to tell you something. At $120 a pop, I want it to be great.
Before you go,
this is it. Goodbye.
As a we're getting to goodbye. As a personal request, could you play a little bit of more from The Sting? Maybe the song Solace.
Oh, sure. This is Solace, ladies and gentlemen. I always get into my radio voice. Well, thank you very much. This is Marvin Hamlisch on
PRI's Studio 360.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Marvin Hamlisch at the piano in 2009. He died this week at age 68. You can hear another song he performed here at studio360.org.